Hey there, it's Pen. I'm reminding you that Heroes of the Hydean Way and Tales from the Hydean Way are both on Spotify now, and it's a handy way to listen in on top of the RSS feed, Google Podcasts, Google Play Music, which apparently still works, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and pretty much any other place that you can find podcasts. I'm also giving a shout out to our patrons on Patreon. Thank you very much for your support. And now, on to the show.
I stroll down the hangar bay with Christine, spotting a suspiciously familiar ship in a suspiciously familiar state with... Yep, I know that figure. Hey, Ben, do I want to know how you got here and what happened to your poor ship?
Okay, you're here. The Bogwing is hurting pretty bad. I mean, six of the engines are still being repaired, and we're not sure what happened this time. The Imperials are far away from here, the bounty hunters were all taken care of, even Bosk is off hunting on that preserve still. And no one here is crosswise of us yet.
You got into a firefight with a pack of Herglux.
What the crap are you talking about?
You see the way the engine casing is melted, the damage pattern on the circuitry? What? It's a very distinctive blaster scoring. Welcome to a motivational tale from the Hydean Way. We're your hosts, Christine Chester,
Ben Yendel,
and special guest, Leslie Troutman.
This week,
the heroes are crashing the Tales podcast.
Booyah.
One of the long-running jokes from season one is going to get discussed this episode. Yes, we're just going to start talking about Chris and dishing. No, we're going to be talking about backgrounds.
For those characters who have them.
And those who do not.
Yeah, and we go from season one, where Kith was a huge mystery and still was a very good character, like had good motivations for things, where now we're really early days in season two. You've got a bit of a background, like it's sort of nebulous, as it should be in early days, background for Kev. You've got a bit of a background for Berwyn, at least the stuff that has gone there. You've got a, like, not pages upon pages upon pages of stuff, but you've got a fairly solid one there for Billy. And then you've got Vern, who did something in his past, and now he's on the run with Billy.
Yeah.
Not saying that this is bad. Most of my characters, when I start out characters, are very, shall we say, nebulous. And then I start figuring out what's going on as needed. Like, very Kith-like.
I know a lot of players who take that approach. I'm actually normally the opposite. Like for Nima, I had what, like 2-3 pages when we started that? Like I knew a lot about her, had a lot of proper nouns in her background, and that's usually my approach. I would say like 95% of all characters I play.
Okay.
Cav is unusual. Cav is part of the other 5% where I know just enough to get me out of the gate, and otherwise Cav is a force of nature.
Here's the thing. From me as a GM, I'm looking at, like, Kev, Berwyn, Billy, honestly, even Vern, and not Vern, Vern.
So we're not talking about the neighbor in the Ernest movies.
Any of the four characters does have enough background to make the obligation work. Especially in Edge of the Empire, that's the bare minimum of background that you need. What does the obligation mean?
True. I feel like obligation is definitely more backstory informed than duty has to be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can definitely have overlap and source material there, but it's not like Kith's backstory did not set her up as a saboteur explicitly, but it just worked out really well that would be what she would be good at. Not that any of you know.
And Force and Destiny has kind of the same situation where the morality system, it'll define something about your character, but not where they came from. More who they are.
If you take a look at the suggested character creation methodology, you start off with a concept for the character. Like, essentially, the background for the character is the first thing to start off with. And the second to last thing you do is figure out what their motivation is, which so many players just skip right over. What's my motivation?
Cav has one.
To get that close up.
Honestly, motivations are so handy, especially when you're trying to meld things in.
Right.
The question I sort of pose to you two is, how do you strike the balance between having no backstory? Like, just functionally, this is the person with no name who wandered into the cantina through weird happenstance, part of this adventuring party, to having This is the third part in their epic trilogy, meeting up with these three people for the first time.
But what they don't realize is the three people that they're meeting up with is actually the coming together of the Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
Yeah, that would be a cool campaign.
That would be.
Depends on which side you're on, I guess.
I can answer for myself, at least, and how I personally handle it. Because I tend to be the person who creates a lot of backstory. And I do that for my own benefit. Because I find it very helpful when portraying a character to know a little bit about where they come from in order to figure out how are they going to react to things, what do they know, what don't they know, and play that up. Something I try to do is I leave gaps in that backstory. I try to leave places for the GM to be able to insert things or play around. Or the other thing is being flexible. If something isn't, you know, in that backstory ends up not being as important to the character and we need to change it in order to make something else work, then try to be flexible with that. And in terms of the third act of your epic story or whatever, just if you're playing like a level one D&D character or say a, you know, brand new, no experience Edge of the Empire character, don't have a super elaborate backstory with like 30 years of experience unless there's maybe reasons for that is kind of mm-hmm. how I've the approach I've taken. Like a character concept I actually have I may use on Heroes at some point is playing a much, much older character, but somebody who's been out of the action long enough that the experience isn't there exactly. Or the body perhaps is not as willing to enact what the mind might recall.
The flesh is spongy and bruised.
There are ways to play around with it and justify, like, hey, this is why this character is that way. And you know, if you are going to start adding big, elaborate things to their backstory, you got to come up with a reason why you can't do that anymore or turn that into something else. You know, like it can be fodder, but be reasonable.
Well, I actually do have an older character in one of my games, one of the College Bro games. Good grief. We have two active stories and a basically West Marches style game, which I now know what that means. Uh-huh. I've had that explained to me. But in one of them, I play a 40-something-year-old shopkeep.
Okay.
She is an entrepreneur or one of the money-based, like something that would make sense for a shopkeep. But she will probably be cross-specking at some point into something more functional. For the moment right now, the reason she's along the ride with these questionable individuals is they kind of set up base in her shop. Like, she became known as the donut lady because I just kept making jokes about making coffee and donuts for everyone.
Cav would like
and
this
so
woman.
She's now like known locally as the donut lady. She bribes people with fresh donuts. And she recently accompanied them to some kind of altar in the basement of a museum that was going to drain the life force of all the people in the city, and there were explosions and madness. Yeah, she's a little over her head, but, you know, she is partially past her backstory and partially creating a new one at this point.
Kind of like she's more taking her first steps into that larger world, just she's doing it at a later stage in her life.
And I mean, technically, she has a lot of backstory in a way because her obligation is debt. Because her husband made some questionable deals, we'll say. And so she ended up, her two eldest children have their own business and are far away from the incident. And she ended up sending her youngest back to live with her parents to get the youngest somewhere safe. So depending on what mood the GM is in, I mean, there are all sorts of strings to pull on her, on world and off. See, I can do backstory. Chris.
I'm coming at this from a person who oh so rarely plays. So when I'm coming up with backstory for a character, it's usually like a big bad. Like, why is my big bad actually doing something? How have the characters actually gotten to a point where the big bad actually needs a backstory?
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm very freeform in the way some of my adventures go. Unless I'm running a module, in which case, hey look, big bad's pretty much set. I mean, really.
It's like somebody else did the legwork for you.
Except then I have to figure out what the heck they did, which it's one of those, like, looking at little sheepish dog, what did you do? What did you do?
What did you do, Ray?
My big experience with backgrounds is what players are trying to bring to the adventure.
Mm.
I have come to really appreciate the sort of short form backstory. Say you are playing that wizened old hermit that is finally kicked out of their enclave or out of their hut in the middle of the swamp to actually do something. The background not having to be deep, but having a couple NPCs in your background, especially ones like you care about, really help out.
Yeah.
Like even from a pre-made adventure, you can then still customize it to things that the players have brought forth.
Mama Ordo, for instance.
Yeah.
Mala as another one.
Right. It's actually been something I've been thinking about for Cav with Season 2. Because right now, I don't have any NPCs in that background. That's something...
You've got a bunch. They've all got one name.
That's the other funny thing.
So is this Uncle Gand, Aunt Gand, Second Cousin Gand?
I don't think those distinctions mean the same thing to them.
Female Progenitor Gand.
I'm just looking forward to the day where, another member of the Cav clan throws up, who also hasn't earned a first name, but has earned the use of the clan name, and it just gets confusing.
We'll just start addressing all conversations to the translation droids. Like, K1, help us out here. This Cav holding the speaking conch.
That's probably how K1 would distinguish them.
Probably.
How she's going to name the future droids.
I like the idea of K1 actually giving them different voices.
That's probably something that will happen just by virtue of the fact that Ben would probably be playing one, I'll be playing one.
True.
I just might have to do my K1 underlay, but anyway.
So one of the things that we've said is having an NPC in your background helps, because then it gives a entry point and something that you as a player can see come forward and show up.
It also avoids the, like, orphan adventurer stereotype.
I'm feeling very attacked right now.
Even with the orphan adventurer, orphans generally have people that they know.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, you're going to have your Fagin or your Tony Falcone, you know, the person that helped you out or trapped you
mm-hmm.
in whatever life you're in. Maybe the person that orphaned you, depending on the circumstances.
That's true, too. My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
Precisely.
Like, to me, that like orphan stereotype, yeah, you can have a character without a family, but you do still have people who are important to you, who maybe raised you or helped you out or mentored you or whatever.
Having it be a lot more general than just, okay, this is your family from your past, makes it more open to everyone. When someone says to me, oh, your sister has arrived or your brother has arrived, I've got no idea. It's one of those things of, okay, there's the changeling, kill them. Because as a person, like as me, I don't have siblings. And because I don't have siblings, me as a player, I don't get into the headspace of having siblings. So it's like, who is this imposter?
So Ben's not the eternal orphan, but he is the eternal only child.
Yes.
Like, I'm an only child, and like, I'm the opposite. I love playing around with having siblings in games because I never had that. Like, that's one of my favorite things, to try to like understand that relationship and sort of mimic what I see from other people or put my own spin on it. Some of my favorite like character relationships I've had in the last couple years have been when I actually played like the sister to a like PC brother. I had so much fun with the bickering and the...
Like, you were actually the sibling to another player?
Yeah.
Okay. Just making sure I was interpreting that correctly.
Jeff from the Thursday night game and I played Nautilin siblings.
Nautilins are so cool, man.
They really are.
Yeah, and we had so much fun with that.
There are many ways of creating a background. There's a few ways that a lot of people seem to like, or at least ones that have been codified into rules that kind of work for creating a party. I'm thinking of the Fate Core ones, where you come up with a paragraph for something that you've done, then pass it to the person on the left, and they write a paragraph building on what you said, and to the left again, and that way you've got a single through line for what other people have done with you.
Mm-hmm. The party has a connection. They're not all strangers on day one.
That can definitely work. Thing about that, though, is that it doesn't allow for too much to come from outside. Like, it works well on creating the internal relationships to the party, but the external relationships can essentially become forgotten.
Have I ever told you about my 3x3 method?
Like tic-tac-toe?
Kinda.
I have no idea what you're talking about, crazy person.
Something I'm big on character backstory and making, like, when I'm GMing and making use of, like, players' backstories. And one of the things I did, and this is probably, I may not go this far in future games, but back in the day, I had a 3x3 chart where every PC needed to declare three allies of their character. They could be family, war buddy, mentor, whatever. Three, like, acquaintances. It could be a guy who owes you a favor. It could be you're really close to your bartender. It could be, you know, whatever. And then three antagonists. It could be there's this you know, one cop that's always ticketing your car when you're just a little bit out of the parking space. Or it could be, you know, your mortal nemesis has been hunting you down. But just to kind of add life to a campaign, everybody's bringing in nine characters.
That's pretty intense.
Yeah, I may not go. I probably wouldn't do this many in future campaigns, but back in the day, I did this and it worked very well for my purposes then and added a lot of life to a campaign because even like some players had like an ally who was dead and it was more like the echoes of that character. Other ones, they were just kind of bit parts that might pop up here and there. Some of them didn't get used. It was mostly like, here's this array I can kind of pick from. And if somebody showed up, it got that player excited and invested. And
that amount of being invested in the character and in the world, that is the giant thing that helps. Even if you're to pare that down to having one of each, one ally, one rival, and one contact, that's still three people that everyone's bringing to the adventure. If we look at heroes, that would be 12 people.
Yeah, that's going to end up being quite the background party.
If every one of the heroes were to do that, I don't know that I'd be able to get around to all of them. But I would go out of my way to make sure one from everyone did get used.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's the rival, the contact, or the ally.
Right.
We probably should toss this into the chat. Doing that does allow for a place for the player to be creative beyond just their character. It's pushing off some of the development into the world, some of the world building to the other players. And it isn't just the GM who's having to create everything and come up with everything. It's now, well, this contact that everyone's going to is this particular player's creation.
Now, we talked a little bit up at the start about the players who sort of come to a game and they kind of create their backstory once they get a handle on the character's voice and who they are in the present. Mm-hmm. How do you handle that as a GM, Ben? Is that something you're like, are you okay with that when players kind of need a few sessions under their belt before they start to expand? Do you prefer them to have like a little something?
Yes. As a GM, I am absolutely of the camp that until you have played this character at least a few sessions, you have no idea what this character is.
Mm-hmm.
You can come to me with a 50-page backstory. I won't believe that that actually is this character's backstory until you've played the character. Any backstory that's done before the session, if especially the tighter it gets, the less likely it's going to actually inform play at the table.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that Kev did something to get their name, the points that Kev has, the points that Billy has, the points that Berwyn has, the point that Vurin has, that they've all got points in their background, they have something to work with, but it isn't tight in on themselves. So going forward, we have space to add something to the background if it ever needs to happen. The best way I've got it is right now we've got three sets of Schrodinger's parents.
Fair point, yeah.
Are they alive? Who knows?
And one Schrodinger's...
Yeah, who knows about Billy?
Assembler.
You've got the assembler.
Well, even you have your previous owner, mm-hmm. which we know nothing about that person.
Well, yeah.
Well, the other players don't anyway.
Billy's just another orphan, guys.
Sure.
Off to seek her fortune.
Through the cards.
Mm-hmm.
That's a reason why I like, even like a full page backstory, you can't put truly defining stuff in one page. You can put like one event that was amazingly crucial to this character and that is going to echo through this character through the roleplay. But there is no way you can define an entire character in a page or two.
As somebody who frequently rolls with characters that are more concept than established, I think you can get a lot from one page.
Oh, you absolutely can.
Like, at least a really decent trampoline, if not a full-on skate park.
This has me thinking of Leverage. This has me thinking of the... They want to call them director's commentaries. They're producer's commentaries of Leverage season 2 through 5.
What?
And through that, one of the things that routinely comes up with is the character of Elliot. Well,
he's a very distinctive character.
See, that reference I get.
For Elliot, there is no way you are ever going to find out all of his previous work. You've got season 3 where you're going up against one of his old bosses, but you're never going to know everyone who has hired him, everyone who's had him on his employ. Mm-hmm. It hems the character in too tight.
Well, with Sophie as well, you're never going to know all of her roles. You know, they've created these characters that are immense, but you get to see enough of their background in circumstances that you get to understand them better as characters.
And if you had overwritten the Sophie character, you would never have had the ability for her to eventually go on and be a... Like, she's a grifter, so it's probably not true, but she was playing a royal for an episode, and one that was recognized as a royal.
A identity she had played for so many years, I know Nate was wondering, was that who she had been at the time?
If you had had the sort of failed actress that was there at the beginning of the series, and that was all that that character could be, you would never be able to get to some of the later heights that are done.
Right.
The reason why I was picking on Elliot for this is in the second episode, the one where they're doing the sting on the mafia boss, there's just a throwaway line that's in there. Hold a knife like this to cut vegetables, hold a knife like this to cut throats.
That says a lot about the character right there.
Cut through like 5 Yakuza in 12 seconds.
It says a huge amount about the character. It says a huge amount about their history. And also that that character is now being the cook. Like not doing lookout, not doing any of that sort of stuff, which they're ostensibly good at. They're being an actual cook.
Yeah.
Then 3 seasons on in season 4, you've got the person who taught them to cook, who saved them from being in an amazingly dark place, is now in trouble. This character has never been referenced before. Mm-hmm. Now, you have the option, because there is this giant black hole in their background, you can put a little pin in there and say, this is something from their backstory. And it's something that's important to the player, to the writer of Elliot, that yeah, this guy can cook. He can cook well. He can cook well enough that he's actually considered at the level of being a chef. So he was taught.
And from the RPG context, like, you know, Leverage being a written show, they whether that was just a gag and later on they used it or they knew his, you know, that part of his backstory all along, I'm not quite sure. But from an RPG standpoint, you also then allows opportunities for layers you weren't expecting to be added to a character. 2 things come to mind immediately. One is an example from Critical Role, which was for their second campaign. The wizard Caleb was kind of smelly and beat up at the start. That was intended to just be like that day. The other characters latched onto it, and that became a defining thing for that character going forward. That he purposely then did that as like a means to like disguise himself. Or for Heroes, and a little thing I don't know where it's going to go. I think this will come out after episode 1 is released. But the coupon gag.
Oh, yeah.
Was just tossed out by David and Leslie. We're batting that back and forth. And I just chimed in about Cav, you know, liking coupons, being the sort of person to do that. And that joke carried on into the next episode. And is now like Cav being the bargain hunter.
Mm-hmm.
is now stuck in my head. Like, Cav is that person who's looking for the deal, who's going to go for the cheapest thing and find ways to cut corners and be very frugal in that sense.
You actually have a pretty good background. In all seriousness, all four of you have pretty decent backgrounds for your characters. But by not having them extensive, you have the ability to roll with it.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of like, there's several things where I'm just sort of poking at like random questions that cross my mind. As a GM, I'll just DM one of you. And is this a thing? Has anyone...
Yeah, you just did that to me the other day, and I was like, what? Okay.
Mysterious.
Being able to be fast and loose with a character allows you to build up tropes with the character. If you can already come with a trope, that's cool. But you don't have to. With backstories and me being the GM of it, I'm eager to accept either which way. The player's coming to me with a bit of a backstory, or players coming to me with no backstory, and we'll just see. The two that frustrate me as a GM, but I'll still work with them, is those who aggressively have no background, where they're not willing to try and develop one. It's like, how does your character know about this? Where does your character get this obligation? Why does your character have this motivation? Well, I don't know. They just do. It's on the page.
Arg.
I play background sparingly, as has been noted previously. But I'm a little better than that, because usually when I come to a character, if I don't actually have a specific story I want to tell or role I want to fill, I'll at least have a person in mind for who I want to play, which will give me a flavor of background and a flavor of obligation / motivation to play with. So, I mean, like, Kith, I didn't know the people I was going to be playing with. I hadn't really played with Ben.
True.
I was really only getting to know everybody. And that's one of the reasons, when I don't know what I'm doing, I default to anomalous support. Chris had this really cool character concept. Christine clearly knew what she wanted to do. Brent knew what he was doing. I don't know how much he seemed like he knew his backstory. I'm like, okay, so these guys clearly have stories going on. I want to play someone that's fun and interesting, but not too pushy story-wise. So I was like, okay, so I'll be a new recruit. And as time went by, I hammered out the specificity internally of why Kith was with the Rebellion, how she came to be on this squad, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. From the start, however, it was basically, okay, she's young, she's a smart mouth, she came from this style of background, which would be the city garage.
Mm-hmm.
I had, like, an idea of how she got there, but I hadn't hashed out, like, this happened this day and she was picked up by the cops or something. I don't know. Well, I do know, but I'm not telling you because I'm a jerk.
I don't know if you need to, though. Like, you know, as much of a hassle as we've given you over it, Kith had a lot of character in spite of we never digging deeper into her past.
Okay, here's the thing, is that the rest of the heroes didn't. Leslie will attest, I kept on pestering her because I was trying to do the same sort of thing as I was for, like I was trying to do for Brent, I was trying to do for you, Christine, I was doing for Chris.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to pull something from Kith's backstory into the present, and I was trying to work with Leslie to do that.
I was relatively recalcitrant pill until I got excited about an idea, and then I sent him like a 5-page story.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's 3 pages, but still.
Heroes was an entirely learning experience for me. Like, I had some ideas going into it, but it was, so much of that was learning for me in how to deal with a group that's just coming together. Now for season 2, to kind of circle back to something that we had talked of earlier, the ally, the contact, and the rival, that I'm going to probably bring up, say, I would like you to come up with these for me between the end of Trouble Brewing and the start of Mask of the Pirate Queen. At that point, I'm very certain that the four of you will know the characters. You may not know them completely. We may not have mapped out where they're going because you have no idea what Mask of the Pirate Queen will do. You will be confident enough in what the characters are to know what kind of characters should be around them.
Just as we've been talking, I know the answer to one of those 3 questions. I don't know the other two yet, but one of them has popped into my mind. It actually explains some of why Cav is Cav, but... I will save that for when I've actually written it down.
My question for the two of you, this isn't a final one, but this is, like, we are getting closer. The question I've got for the two of you is, how much does a motivation matter for your character? Like, we've talked a lot about background, we've talked the entire episode about it, but in the same sort of realm is motivation, or in my thoughts, should be.
Are you talking about the mechanic motivation? Yes. 'Cause I don't know that I've ever really written much down in motivation. I made an effort with Billy just because there are all of these blanks on the character sheet and I felt guilty not filling more of them in. But, like, I don't think there was really anything on Kit's paperwork.
For me, it depends on the character. I actually find with Cav, having a little less of the backstory defined, motivation is huge. I know what Cav wants, and it defines everything Cav does in Cav's own strange way. But then I know, like, on the flip side with Nima, what I wrote down as motivation kind of came up, because there were things like her dislike of slavery, which was kind of worded in her motivation, and I kind of played up the redemption thing a bit, but she was also kind of a drunk. I don't know. I don't think it was as defining for her. I think she kind of made up her own mind from scene to scene, and I think that's how it is with most of my characters. For some, they need that drive. They need to be pushed forward, and for other ones, they're more flexible. They're more, what's the situation we're in? Okay, I care about X, Y, and Z. And maybe that over time becomes more of a motivation as I realize, like, oh, well, this character reacts in this way to this situation.
Absolutely.
What about you, Ben?
I play one shots.
But hold on a second, though. But you GM campaigns and you were talking about your villains, and you do also play a lot of reoccurring NPCs, especially for things like heroes as we gather up our pets. Like, do you have, like, motivation for, say, Vrebo as an instance, or for, you know, your villain characters?
The villain in Trouble Brewing is very
straightforward.
Well, Trouble Brewing itself is also an amazingly straightforward adventure. It's kind of its own beginner adventure where you're just sort of taking a look at, hey, look, you can do all this stuff. It's actually really fun that way. As an aside, I would use Trouble Brewing as a first adventure for teaching people if you're going to turn into doing a campaign versus running them through the beginner box, just because it's less defined. Okay, for my NPCs, if they're named, I do have motivations, and I do have a direction that they're wanting to go. For the villains, okay, the villains and heroes are a complex thing, especially going into Mask of the Pirate Queen. Mask of the Pirate Queen has a lot of moving parts in the background. I honestly think the adventure itself does it well, and I'm going to do my best to bring it to the fore. It starts off pretty simple, and then you can start seeing, hey, look, there actually are moving parts. Instead of just, hey, let's go do this. And, oh, there's a good reason for you all to be doing the, hey, let's go do this.
Don't you just feel good when he does that?
There's the laugh again.
This makes you feel really good inside.
Act 1 for Mask of Pirate Queen is going to be amazing. It's Act 2 that's going to be brilliant, technically, the transition between the two. And Act 2 is just going to be absolutely off the wall, and I can't wait to put all y'all through Act 2.
Well, I'm excited.
Okay, the Pirate Queen has her motivation. She has a wider plot than I would normally figure for it. The Pirate Queen absolutely has motivations for what they're doing. A lot of her lieutenants have motivations for what they're doing. Like, and there are decent, at least two-dimensional characters in this adventure. It's great. So you've got an idea of what they're going to do when the players go off the wall.
Do you expect us to go off the wall?
Ceiling, walls, floors, like a bouncy ball.
I just want to say, I said that with a straight face.
I didn't even intend to do this, but it's like there was a challenge left to me by Chris to be more creative, and I just grabbed it and I run with it.
That's perfect. Anyone with a name that has stuck around does have a motivation for it. It may be simple, like Zakata. Zakata, I messed up her motivation, and she was supposed to be a lot slyer than she turns out to be in the second episode, which, yeah, this will air far after, that she is supposed to be a lot more circumspect about why she's at Formos. Her motivation is to rescue her brother, or at least find out what the heck happened to him. Like, that is her motivation. That's why she would tag along with the group. That's why she's doing most of the things that she is. That's what led her to Formos. The question then becomes, is the party going to find her brother? If they do, what state is he going to be in?
Inebriation.
Possibly. Assuming he's alive.
If that happens, he should share with us. It would be only fair.
And she wasn't drunk yet.
They have motivations. W9 has a very clear motivation at this point.
Revenge.
W9 is a R4 unit that wants revenge. That's what W9 wants. He knows who's responsible, and he knows who's responsible for that person. The person responsible is now no more. The one who's responsible for that person is who he's setting a bounty hunting group on.
I feel so used, but that's kind of the point.
But each of them do have a motivation. I'd actually go so far as to say pretty much any of the name that show up in a FFG module, even Trouble Brewing, do have at least a simple motivation. Even the jerk in the Biscuit Baron had a motivation. It was a very simple one, and he paid the price for it properly, but
yep,
he had a motivation.
He chose poorly.
As a GM, my NPCs do have motivations because they kind of need it, because they may not have the background, especially if they don't tie into... Christine, you actually said it earlier. The less of a background you have, the more motivation is needed. The thing that I've sort of have come in my mind to think about motivation and background is, I really sort of look at them as a bow and arrow. Like, background is sort of the bow where everything has come from, everything that is propelling you forward. The motivation is the arrow. And at the start, it is going where you think it is. And to start off with, your motivation is one thing. Where it ends up is not necessarily the same thing that you are aiming at. So your motivations can change. They will change. In a lot of cases, they should change. And in doing so, you're creating an arc for the character to happen, like an arrow.
Ben's like, I found a metaphor that works. I'm keeping it. Good for you.
Christine, Leslie, do you have any final thought about backstory or motivation for our listeners so that they can crystallize and figure out a way to make their backstory work for them? Or their background, I mean, really, that could also work.
Kind of echoing a bit of what you said earlier, as well as something David said during the session zero, give some gifts to your GM. Give some hooks, at least in terms of a backstory or some NPCs, something that they can work with. You will end up having more fun with it in the long run as well, as those elements end up coming back up.
As a veteran, shallow backstory player, and the funny thing is, I'm just going to say this now. Kit's backstory is about as long as Billy's. It's just very, very different. So Billy has a very small backstory, but it's really expansive in its own little way. Whatever you do when you're creating your character, however you come at it, find something in your backstory to be excited about. For Kith, it was the garage. Like, that was something that was really important to her. It was something she could use to kind of leverage her understanding of the world. You know, give yourself a shape to fill and get excited about. And don't be afraid to go, hey, GM, I had this thought. What if? Because chances are your GM's kind of like, how can I torture you discreetly? But just find something to have fun with and be excited about, even if it is a dark and stormy night where both of your parents failed to show up your birth, you know, whatever.
Wait, what?
Orphans are cool too, tropey or not. I've played orphans that I've loved.
Expanding on what you're saying is, for me, the player group is essentially about found family. It's, I guess that's the reason why I'm drawn to something like Star Trek or The Fast and the Furious, because it's about family. It's about the, not necessarily who was your family, but who is your family now. I think that's the reason why I like The Expanse so much, is because it's about a found family and leverage and like all the other ones that I keep hyping up. Having a background to bring means that there are more situations in the world for you to care about. And caring about things in the world, it seems scary at first, especially handing this over to someone who, as Leslie was hinting at, could just end up torturing you with the things that you said. But in the end, especially in this system, you're here to tell stories together. And the more interesting things that you can add to the stories from a planning, where the GM can put a lot of their sort of spare thought into it, that'll just make it better. Smudge, I hate to do this to you, but you fired on the Pogwing. Now, if you'd be kind enough to succumb to the sleeper hold. I mean, I have never seen anyone just wear someone else like a cape before. Christine, Leslie, a little help here?
I look down the sights of the Ascension Launcher. I've got your back, Ben. I fire the cable and brace myself as it wraps around one of Smudge's tree trunk legs. Ah!
Shifting my grip on the pry bar I found, I see Christine dragged off her feet by the powerful Herglick. Well, that changes that plan. Time to wing it. Using my whole 5 minutes of briefing on the situation, I charge in swinging. By the force, I hope they have kneecaps. Timber! Join us next time on A Lumberjack's Tale from the Hydean Way. You can find the show on Twitter at The Hydean Way and me at LeslieGS.
You can find me on Twitter at 12th Night. That's 12th and Night with a K.
And you can find me at Deuterium Ice. We are all at TheHydeanWay.com, where you can find previous episodes, links to things we talk about on the show, and our live play podcast, Heroes of the Hydean Way.
Our podcast is on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher, where you can find more episodes and help us out by rating and reviewing the show.
Drop us a holocom at tales@thehydeanway.com.
We're also on Facebook as Tales from the Hydean Way.
If you like what we do and you want to support the show, you can find us at patreon.com/thehydeanway.
Or give us a coffee at ko-fi.com/thehydeanway. Nothing. I'll just stop talking.
I just realized something. Hold on, I need to turn this into a hot box.
Ow!
Hey, if you didn't start laughing, I wouldn't have, but...
What did you do, Christine?
I turned around, and you know that little table your printer sits on? I just bashed my knee into it.
The printer table that's always been there and never moved.
It's right behind me. I had to turn around to close the window.
It jumps.
I'm trying to give Ben quality sound.
Dastardly printer.
My knee hurts.
Be where it's put for the past like 2 years.
I'm so glad that got recorded. There were bloopers in this show. I know what's going in them.
Pause. Ow.
Okay.
Are you done hurting yourself, darling?
For the moment. I mean, I'm sure I'll get back around to it.
Okay, that's gone. Okay.
Cue us, boss man.